This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering the largest selection of audiobooks for your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 186, Giant Life-Altering Enigma. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Will Wynn. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the visual effects fixes that have been made to the Netflix version of TNG, and the diverse and Star Wars-like aliens found in the Abramsverse, like the one seen being carried in the recent Star Trek Beyond video. Then in the feature, we're joined by Philip Gilfus and Jeremy Reed to discuss the DS9 episode, The Visitor. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Will. It's great to have you here with me on The Ready Room. I'm having a different co-host every week recently, which is one of the things I love about this show. The Ready Room is all about bringing together hosts from all around the network and our frequent guests and just talking about every corner of the Star Trek universe. How's everything going?
Things are going well. I'm excited. I'm wearing not only a Deep Space Nine shirt, I'm also wearing a Deep Space Nine hat because I'm very excited to be on a DS9 Ready Room. So things are going well.
Well, I'm glad to see that you did wear your DS9 gear today because based on recent photos you've been posting, I thought you were going to come to the show as the Green Lantern.
Yes. So when I embrace a fandom, I tend to go like really in depth to it. So like I was like, all right, I'm going to retire Star Trek for a while. I'm going to go into another fandom and we'd be like, all right, let's change my profile picture. Let's change my cover photo. But you're right. There was about a 50-50 chance I was going to be Green Lantern for this one, but I figured that might have been a bridge too far.
I don't know. You know, you can do it as a crossover in comics, so why
not?
That's
true. That is true.
Well, I'm really excited to talk about the episode we're going to talk about today, which is The Visitor, because it's such a moving episode and there are so many ways to approach it. And before we do that, of course, we have some news to talk about. Before we talk about the news, I'd like to remind everyone of a couple of things. And one of those is the fact that The Ready Room here is just one of the many, many shows that we have here on the network. Trek FM is a family of 20 or so shows, because we have special programming as well, covering every aspect of the Star Trek universe. And Will, you do a show here on the network, Warp 5, with Norm Lau about Enterprise. And tell everyone about that real quick.
Yeah, so it's all about the last Star Trek series to be on thus far on Star Trek Enterprise. So it's all about the adventures of the NX-01, Captain Archer, and most importantly, Porthos and his adventures in the early Federation. No, I'm just joking. It's for the most part.
I thought you were going to say most importantly, the Decon Chamber.
And most important, of course, the Decon Chamber, where we always use Decon Gel E. And
yes, that's the best one.
Right. You know, so
got to have the E.
Exactly. So I'm co-host with Norm on that, and Norm's an executive producer for the network, and we have a great time talking Enterprise because I feel like a lot of people are rediscovering the show, and the show just has a lot of potential in terms of discussion because it is in this unique space of it's a prequel, but it's also the last Star Trek to be made. There's so much to talk about what Enterprise brought to the franchise and what it could have brought. So always have a fun discussion on Warp 5, and I also do the Roundtable, which is a patrons roundtable, which we have every month where we just have patrons of the network talk to the hosts about all things Trek, so it's a great place just to interact with the audience.
Yeah, that's fantastic, the Roundtable I especially love. And yeah, you guys are doing a great job with Warp 5. I used to host that show, and then I turned that over to you guys. And it's very popular. You know, Enterprise is a series that a lot of fans haven't seen or they say they don't like, but then people watch it and they get into our podcast about it and find out they really love it. So that's an example. I mean, Warp 5 is an example. We have shows like that for every series. Of course, we've got Mission Log with John and Ken. We've got the 602 Club with Matthew, which is about all kinds of geek topics, even beyond Star Trek. So many things for you to check out. If you're an Apple user, go to itunes.com/trekafilm, and that'll kick you over into our artist section in the iTunes store. We are a featured provider with Apple, and we really thank Apple for their support of what we're doing here and giving us that section. And if you're not an Apple user, you can get us on Stitcher or Spreaker or BlackBerry, Windows Phone, SoundCloud. Go to our website, stream from the show page, grab the RSS link. You can find us in all the podcast apps on iOS and Android. And this show, The Ready Room, is actually available in Spotify as well. So if you're a Spotify user, you can listen to us there. Many ways for you to get our programming, but go check it out. We have so much stuff for you beyond this show. The other thing I want to remind everyone of really quickly is we are a listener-supported network, and people support us through Patreon. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And the roundtable that Will just mentioned is one of the perks. That's at the $25 level or higher. And it's like a show here. It's like a feature discussion. You know, our patrons get together with us and we talk about Star Trek, and it's really fantastic. And you can listen to that through the master feed, Trek of Him Complete Master Feed, which you can get in all those places as well. And I love those discussions. So please go check that out. And also, if you love what we're doing here on the network and on this show, please consider supporting us at patreon.com/trekfm. Okay, let's get into news, Will. The first thing that we're going to talk about is TNG. And this one was really interesting to me because, of course, I've had TNG on DVD for many years. Then the Blu-rays came out. I got really excited about the visual effects. And to show you just how dedicated the team is at CBS to making sure that we have the definitive remaster TNG, now that Netflix is showing TNG in HD, they've gone back in and fixed yet more things that slipped through the cracks on the Blu-rays. What did you think about these little touches that they put on here?
So it's amazing that when I actually read this article on TrekCore when it first came out and I was reading the changes that they made, in my mind, I'm like, wow, I would have never have noticed any of these things unless they actually mentioned it. And I think it's so, like you said, Chris, it speaks to the dedication of the team at CBS for them to go back and do this, although just for the streaming version, because it'd be too logistically impossible to kind of do it for the physical Blu-rays. But for the streaming versions of the high-def shows, they've been able to make these changes and release it as it's become available on Netflix, as it's been available on Amazon Prime. And I think it's very interesting. I mean, I'm a huge Star Trek nerd, but I'm looking through this, I'm like, I would have never noticed any of these changes, you know, in terms of, you know, Akamar 3 keeps on spinning. I would have never really thought about that until now. And I think it really does speak to dedication of the crew. But I must say, I think the one thing that I wish they did change, but they deliberately decided not to, was in Timescape when they decided to keep that beam from where they launched the photon torpedo. I know that was a big deal. And for a long time, for years, fans were talking about that was a change that they're looking forward to. And in the end, they just decide to keep it as is. I hoped at the time that they would have changed it. I understand why they didn't do it, but I always thought, like, why is that coming out of the photon torpedo tubes?
And see, and I don't even notice those things personally because I don't care that much about those technical aspects of how the ship works from an engineering standpoint. Those don't bother me when it comes to the story, but I know for a lot of fans it really does bother them. And the vengeance factor is the one where you're talking about Akamar 3 stops spinning. Now that would be really troubling though. Like, I never noticed that, but if someone told me about it and then I look, I would think, oh my God, a planet stopped spinning. I mean, is Q here? What's going on in this story, right?
Exactly. So it
kind of could impact the story a little bit. Another one here, Brothers. The ship, the bridge is at red alert on the Blu-ray when it should be on blue alert. And they fixed it to blue alert on Netflix. That's another one that I never noticed. Doesn't bother me at all in terms of a story point. But I think it's cool that they care enough to go in one more time and just make that change.
That is so nerdy. I love it. In fact, is that the only time there's a blue alert? Because I was like, wow, there's actually a blue alert? Like, that is so cool.
Well, they do blue alert on Voyager.
Oh, yeah, they did for when they landed, right?
Yeah, blue was when they landed. And I feel like, and I could be wrong here, I feel like they then used blue alert in a different situation at some point later on. But yeah, when Voyager lands in Basics, I think is the first time it actually lands on a planet, mm-hmm. they go to blue alert for the landing. And I don't recall the Enterprise D being on blue alert. I mean, it's on blue alert because of the... They say the environmental issue on the bridge at this point in Brothers, it would be at blue alert. But here it is. And speaking of blue, another one that's changed here, which I never noticed and doesn't bother me at all, is in Imaginary Friend, when Deanna and Clara, the little girl, are leaving 10 Forward. If you look through the door... Look through the crack into 10 Forward, you can see blue screen in the windows. And then also, you can still see that blue screen after the doors have closed, and you've got the little glass circles with the Starfleet emblem on the doors. You can see the blue through there as well. So they went through and they changed that so that it's black in Starfield when you look through the windows, and then it's dark in the circles when the doors closed.
Again, crazy. I would have never noticed this. But because they say I'm going to laser in like an eagle to see it now. I think it's great.
And that's great. Now, will they go back to Insurrection and fix the entire set that's all blue screen when Picard's having the
fight? That's crazy because when I first saw it, and I think I was 12 when I first saw it, it never occurred to me. Only after the fact in high school did someone mention in a message board that, did you know that they ran out of money, that literally the collector was blue screen? I'm all like, my God, that's so true.
whole thing is blue screen.
But you're right. I think Insurrection is definitely due for a George Lucas type revisit where perhaps the blue screen now has like holograms maybe in a very like... it's like a Daniels temporal Cold War. Like, it's just so much going on.
Oh, wow. Wow, that would be wild. Yeah. And then the last one here is in Relics. And this is another one I never noticed. But yes, scientifically, it's good that they fixed this. This is the fact that once the Enterprise is inside the Dyson Sphere, when they're looking at the star, you can see other stars in the background, which, of course, you shouldn't be able to see if they're inside the Dyson Sphere. So they've gone in and they fixed that.
I mean, that's attention to detail. I mean, that's why TNG has science consultants, right, for stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But I think I've noticed that on this list, they didn't have the fix to Birthright. Because remember, there was that famous blooper where when Bashir meets Data, and at the end of Birthright Part 1, as Bashir is walking away, I think he was wearing... like booties over his shoes, because when they were filming the show, oftentimes they had to put these on because it had too much noise. So a lot of the background actors had to wear these booties, so they had so much noise. Yeah. But there's a quick scene of Bashir walking away, and you see him wearing this medical type booties. But I don't know if they fixed that, but I noticed that. So.
So the other thing that they say they did not fix, which some fans would like them to fix, is the entire season 2 of TNG Remastered.
That's also true.
Which, again, I have to say, because I don't care that much about these types of details, I'm not bothered that much by the remastering of season 2, which was done by an outside group, by HTV Illuminate instead of CBS. Though I will admit that it is subpar compared to the others. It's sort of striking that you watch season 1 remastered, which is done really well, and then you get to season 2 and you're like, yeah, this is kind of not up to par. And then season 3, wow, this is great again. So it is unfortunate, but I'm pretty sure this season 2 is what we're going to always have, because I cannot see them, especially with the very disappointing sales of the TNG Blu-rays, I can't see CBS ever going back and investing money and completely redoing season 2 once again.
Yeah, I agree. I actually haven't had a chance to watch a lot of the season 2 Blu-rays, but I've heard the same thing, that it was this very noticeable drop in quality.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, but I think this is really cool that they care this much about it. And this is why I think that when we all complain about the fact that we haven't yet, and we probably will not in the near future, get DS9 or Voyager on Blu-ray. Actually, I don't even care if it's Blu-ray. I think that's the problem with the discussion, is that people always say Blu-ray. It's not about Blu-ray. It's not about the media. It's just about remastering in HD for longevity. But I don't want to have that discussion right now. But what I do want to say is that I think that the fact that they go in and they fix these things shows that the creatives themselves would love to give us remastered DS9 and remastered Voyager tomorrow if someone would say, here's some money, go clean this stuff up and make it the best you can for the fans, because they're totally dedicated to it.
So what you're saying is you need a Henry Starling type person to come in and say, you know what, I'm going to give all my money from this company called Chronoworks to redevelop DS9 Voyager.
We need to bankroll it. Or we need to live in the future where Jake can say, at age 37, I gave up my career as a writer. I went back to school, I learned how to do video editing, and I remastered the rest of Star Trek for fans. Because money doesn't matter in the future, so I could just do that.
In the ultimate meta moment where the show references itself.
Right.
Exactly. There's this show called Star Trek Deep Space Nine. I'm also on a station called Deep Space Nine. It's crazy that they're two totally different things, but...
Exactly. It'll be like when news radio referenced themselves.
Oh, did that actually happen?
We found out that news radio was all just happening inside a snowball. It was all a dream.
Oh, I never watched news radio, but that's true.
That's not how the show ended. That was in the middle of the series, but yeah, it's not Newhart. All right. Well, let's go into our other news item here. And this is about Star Trek Beyond.
Man, but you've really got that down. That's really
I've got it down. I practice it on the train, which gets me some really weird looks, but you know, I sacrifice for my art. This is about the video that Simon Pegg shared of they did outtakes of that video where they're promoting the contest where you can visit the set and you can get a cameo and all that. And I'm not so interested in the outtakes, but what I wanted to ask you about is that there's this one thing where accidentally a crew member walks in carrying the bust of a new alien species that I guess will be seen in the movie. And what I wanted to ask you about is, what do you think about the aliens that we see in the Abrams verse? Because one thing that stands out to me with 2009 and Into Darkness is that it's a lot more of a Star Wars feel than a Star Trek feel, where you get all these really unusual aliens. But the question is, would Star Trek have been like that all along if they had had CGI and if they had had more money for prosthetics? Or do you think the type of storytelling that Star Trek is works better when we just have small differences like the forehead bumps and things where you can really identify more with the characters as being human?
That's a really, really good question. To answer the first part of it, what I think of the head that they brought in, I think it's available on most articles about it. It kind of looks like a Gemma Dar. It kind of looks like they've got the scale. They've kind of got the really, I think when Star Trek has the money to do it, they really get into like the forehead and the ridges. Clearly still humanoid, but they really have the ability and time to do the type of facial makeup and the scales and the layering and textures, which I think is really cool. I think it's really neat the fact that you can do that. And I think to be fair, a lot of Star Trek in the movies in the past have been able, because it's a movie, they've been able to say, hey, look at all these aliens that are never going to be on a weekly show because of budget. But like the Federation Council, look at all these weird aliens, or, you know, in that in Star Trek 3 in the bar, McCoy's in there,
which was like a cantina scene.
Exactly. Right.
Right?
It has like a very Star Wars-y feel, like here are all these aliens that we can do one time that we don't need to actually bring back because we can, because it's a movie, which I think is neat. On one hand, I think you're right. It has it's very much sci-fi feel to it, very much Star Wars. And Star Wars has always existed in a movie format, so it could do that. At the same time, you know, Haven't
well, plus they were going to sell action figures of every one of those Batman.
Oh, there's so. George Lucas was the he's less of a movie director, but he's just a master, you know, marketer. Like he's been able, yeah. He was marketing stuff before marketing was a thing, and it's brilliant. And
it's one of my favorite country songs, by the way.
The marketer.
Yeah. I was a marketer when marketing wasn't cool. Yeah, I can't sing as well as Matthew, but you know.
That should be its own release, its own Trek FM musical release. And you know what I actually
listen
to?
Trek FM hosts sing covers of their favorite
songs.
That'd
be songs. So... Oh.
And Patreon perk
that's
right
a Patreon,
there.
You know, I will pay for that right now. I will pay for that right now. I think everyone would pay for that. I'll write that down. It's a good idea. I'm of two minds about it. Because on the one hand, I've always been a critic of the forehead alien of the week. At the same time, like, just something on their head or on their forehead. But I understood the reason why they did it. But I was always a critique of it in terms of, are these aliens really alien if they're just forehead aliens, right? On the other side of it, I can also see how it can sometimes be a crutch in the sense that because you have the ability to have CGI or you have a big makeups effect budget, perhaps that could skew the storytelling that you want to show off that this type of budget. Oftentimes the detriment of the storytelling. I think a lot of what makes Star Trek so great and what makes it so versatile is that so much of its history has been one of cost saving, of budgetary concerns, and because of that, it forced the writers to create actually better stories oftentimes. I think one example is with Enterprise. The reason why there are those three episode arcs in season four, which are so great, is because they needed to stretch their budget. They're like, you know, if we build this mm-hmm. set, if we stretch it over three episodes, we can actually do it. But because of that, they actually were able to tell even better stories. And that's just one example out of many throughout the entire franchise where that was an inadvertent beneficial consequence of it. So
I like the fact
that there's Keenzer and there's the alien that has like the really big eyes. I think that's cool because it helps to establish the fact that this is a universe that's not just inhabited with human actors with prosthetics. But at the same time, it could also be, you know, a situation where the dog is wagging its own tail or chasing its own tail, where like if it's just about the effects, then that's only one piece of the Star Trek pie, if you will. That's only one part of the formula, and you can't only just have one part of it. And if you have a huge budget, sometimes when you have a huge budget, you have to have the Enterprise crash into San Francisco, like Into Darkness, because it costs hundreds of millions of dollars. You have to justify the budget somehow, right?
Yeah.
So I think it can be a double-edged sword.
Yeah. I think for me, it's hard to separate because I think that my feelings about seeing these types of aliens in Star Trek, in the JJ films, is it's a byproduct of having watched the Star Trek the other way, where you don't have such unusual aliens for so many years. If it had always been this way, I probably would feel a little bit differently. So I don't know. I try to approach it. I try to pretend like I can approach it from different angles and see how I feel about it. But the first time when I saw the different aliens that were in the Abrams verse, I was a little bit surprised. And I also wondered, you know, the doctor or the nurse with the big eyes, I was wondering, like, how would Google Glass work on her world? I mean, would that be harder to develop? Do you need bigger sensors? I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's it's all part of the new visual aesthetic that they're establishing, right? So because Star Trek has existed for so long, on the one hand, you have to buy the premise that TOS was in the future, and yet somehow in this future, they didn't invent iPhones or they didn't invent touchscreen technologies. Like somehow that didn't happen, but somehow they can go faster than light, right? But somehow they still have switches, right? And this is an updating of that too, right? Is for so long, we're so used to these aliens being the way they were. And now they're just like, it's almost overload. And
yeah,
I don't know if it's an easy, I don't know if it's a problem that has an easy solution, because I'm sure when the next Star Trek TV series is going to come, they're going to have the same, they're going to expect a certain level of visual polish. Yeah. And that's going to include aliens that look really alien.
Yeah, I think that's what they'll do. And I'm fine with that. I mean, I think realistically, even these aliens are not alien enough for what other life
be like. That's a good point.
Out there. And the aliens that we've gotten over the years on Star Trek are clearly not alien enough. But, you know, if you can step out of the past and what you're accustomed to, then you can say, yes, this aesthetic perhaps makes things one step closer to being more realistic anyway. So anyway.
I got one more point actually on that actually is it's the perpetual debate of can you ever please the fans in the sense that I could see one type of fan saying, oh, another new alien, can't they just do something where they reference other aliens in the past, all the other stuff we've done before? And then on the other hand, when they do that, there'll be other fans who say, oh, give us something new. We've already had the Romulans or the Klingons, right? So it's like, how do you navigate? Like, do you do something really new or do something really old, but then do you risk alienating one fan, pun intended, one fan over the other? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You can't satisfy everyone, and things have to evolve, and that's sometimes hard for us to accept as longtime fans. But all right, well, I'm looking forward to seeing this alien in action anyway in Star Trek Beyond. I wanted to go a little soft there on that one.
That was good.
All right, well, that's all we have in news. So let's go ahead and bring in Philip and Jeremy, and jump into the feature. One of DS9's most loved episodes is The Visitor, and it's a very unique story because it's carried by two actors who are not even part of the normal cast. And today we're going to discuss this episode, and to help us do that, we're joined for, I was surprised to learn this actually as the host of the show, the very first time on a DS9 Ready Room. From our TNG show, Earl Grey, it's Philip Gilfus. Philip, welcome.
Welcome, Chris. I guess the invitation got lost in the mail, so I just decided to come by shuttle and just check out the station, you know. No, it's fine. I just thought I'd come on my own. It's cool. No insults necessary.
We're glad to have you here, and sorry about the invitation. But, you know, we used the same people that Worf and Jadzia used for their wedding invitations, and those never made it to the Enterprise, so I guess I should have known what to expect.
I know. So I'm just looking forward to, you know, the spacious facilities you have available. I'm sure it's all modern, technological, the best that the fleet has to offer. So looking forward to being here on Deep Space Nine.
Right. Welcome aboard. All right. Also joined for the first time in a very long time here on the Ready Room from Star Trek Wars, it's Jeremy Reed. Jeremy, welcome back.
Eldor, joy, everybody. And yeah, it's been about a year, but I know everybody thought I died last year. You mourned, but all of a sudden, boom, right? Flashlight. Here I am back again.
Right. Well, we're going to have to make this quick before you disappear. All right. Well, great to have you back, Jeremy.
Thank you.
All right. So we're going to talk about The Visitor today. This is one of my very favorite DS9 episodes. It's one of my favorite Star Trek episodes. And I think it's just a really great science fiction story in general. It is a unique episode, though, in that we don't see our main cast very much, and even though Jake Sisko is at the center of the episode, he's played by Tony Todd, not Serac Lofton, for most of the story. And that's very unique. For those who haven't seen this episode, go watch it. But if, for the sake of this discussion, if you're going to go ahead and listen now, a quick synopsis. there is an accident when Sisko and Jake go to the Gamma Quadrant to watch an inversion of the wormhole, which is a little bit of scientific techno babble, but apparently the wormhole goes through an inversion every so often, and so it's doing that here.
Did you make a wish when it happened, Chris? You're supposed to make a wish.
Oh, damn it. I didn't. So now I'm going to have to wait a long time to do that again. Plus, I'm going to have to get the Klingons to give me permission to enter the Bajoran system.
So I know a guy, Chris. I know a guy.
All right. I thought you did. So anyway, they go on this field trip, and there's an accident. The Defiant is about to be destroyed by a warp core breach. Sisko saves the day, but something weird happens, and he disappears right before Jake's eyes. Jake thinks he's dead, but it turns out that they are tethered by some sort of subspace connection. And Jake is dragging his father through time. As the years go by, time doesn't pass for Ben because he's in subspace. But Jake grows old. Finally, Jake finds a way to save his father because, you know, Jake's life changes drastically. He stops being a writer. He goes back to school. He studies subspace mechanics. And it sounds like a technical story, but it's actually a very emotional one. And in the end, things are reset. They get a second chance. So that's the basic concept of the story. But let's talk about our initial thoughts here. So, Jeremy, share with us your initial thoughts on The Visitor.
It's one of my all-time favorite episodes in the 700-plus episodes of Star Trek. I remember watching this when it first aired. Was it back in 96? It was immediately was my favorite episode I had ever seen. I would say it's still probably top five out of the 700 episodes of Star Trek. It was emotional to me then, having a father. It's emotional to me now, having children. It's the episode that always has a special place in my heart.
Yeah. How about you, Philip?
Yeah, I don't remember the first time I watched this because I was sort of a latecomer to DS9. But it sort of struck me as, you know, when we mentioned this episode, I sort of jokingly and half serious called it the Guardian of Forever, or the City on the Edge of Forever, you know, DS9 episode, because mm-hmm. I know it's very highly regarded, and it is sort of a very emotional episode.
Do you connect it, as a TNG guy, do you connect it with The Inner Light?
Yeah, and you know, and it's, which I'm, you know, even though I'm a big TNG guy, I'm also sort of, just to be counter-majoritarian, not Inner Light is actually not my, even though that's a very fan favorite, it's not necessarily my favorite. Mm-hmm. But the spirit of it, of going for a more emotional story, you know, Inner Light also doesn't feature the TNG cast, you know, or very briefly it does. Right. But I think with The Visitor, you sort of capture the heart of character or characters in this case more than, you know, because you call it a sci-fi story, which it is, but to me it isn't. And that's not an insult, that it's just a tone, dramatic storytelling, mm-hmm. even with the sci-fi elements aside and Deep Space Nine episode aside, other than the characters of it. So to me it is a very interesting episode and a very different episode, not in a bad way, from DS9, just like Inner Light is very different from TNG, and the other ones probably have ones as well. So it's definitely a standout episode. So I can see why it's definitely a draw for many fans.
How about you, Will?
Yeah, I can only echo what Jeremy and Philip said. It's one of my all-time favorite Star Trek episodes, period, let alone Deep Space Nine. And I'm a huge Deep Space Nine fan, too. And I think it just speaks volumes that This is coming off right off the heels of the very heavy and very action-packed season premiere, Way of the Warrior, season yeah. 4, and this slows it down. But it slows it down. That's not a pejorative. It slows it down in such a good way. It's what makes Star Trek Star Trek, right? You have the action, but then you have the meat of it. The meat of it's the characters, and this episode is all about the character development. And I think it speaks volumes about the Jake Ben relationship, that we still care about the Jake Ben relationship, although Jake is played by Tony Todd, a separate character, and not Sirik Lofton. Well, Sirik, you know, is there and he plays a complimentary role, but I think,
yeah, it's, and he has some important scenes.
He does. He does
in the present time frame, as the show would be,
right?
So Sirik is in this episode.
He is in this episode.
Okay, this is the episode with Sirik Lofton. Okay.
Which is how we know that this episode was not directed by Cliff Bohl.
Exactly.
Because Sirik Lofton is in this episode. Yes,
exactly. but yeah, I think that's the reason why it's so powerful, is that the writing for the relationship between father and son is so strong that you don't even need per se the actor who played the son for it to still be resonant, because the relationship is already there.
Well, my initial thoughts on this, Jeremy, you mentioned that this episode was touching to you when it first aired because of your relationship with your father, and then it's touching to you now as a father. And I passed through both of those phases, of course, and then I am now in the situation where I'm watching it after I lost my father. And I watched this episode last night, and it's actually the first time that I've watched it since my father died. And it was very difficult to watch, and I'm hoping I can get through the show today when we talk about father-son stuff, because it's very difficult. And I also identify with Jake in the situation, because I lost my father because he killed himself, and he left no explanation, and I had talked to him a week before it happened for an hour, and everything seemed perfectly fine. And so just like how Jake loses his father here just suddenly, that's what happened to me as well. And so now this episode has that layer of meaning for me also. But my initial thoughts on the overall concept is that, I think it's really powerful how, or it shows the power of Deep Space Nine as a concept of a show, that this episode can be carried by two non-regular cast members. They're not recurring actors. You know, we don't see, we see Tony Todd in DS9 and of course in TNG as well, but he's as a Klingon. He plays Worf's brother, Kern. And we don't see Rachel Robinson, who I think does a fantastic job in this episode.
Wait, she wasn't Jeffrey Combs in disguise?
She was not, yes. Okay.
They did consider him, though. Jeffrey did try out for the role.
Yeah. If you know in the DS9 Blu-ray sets, if you click around the station, there are all those like little hidden things that are not on the menus, but you can click on a little tile in the station. There actually are the makeup tests of Jeffrey Combs playing Rachel Robinson's character in here. And I think you'll see why they went with Rachel.
You know, I think in actually one of the alternative future scenes in this episode, I did see a copy of the Deep Space Nine Blu-ray sets. So I think that's actually one of the alternative future.
But before he can watch it, it'll disappear. And it'll reappear later on.
It's the only thing Saturday in this episode.
You're reaching for it on the shelf. You want to buy it, and then it vanishes right before your eyes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I think the fact that DS9 can tell such a touching, such a moving story using two actors who aren't even part of the cast and aren't even recurring characters, recurring cast members, shows just how strong the concept of this show is and how well the idea of having this space station with all of these people there in this extended cast works, and that you can tell these kinds of stories. So let's talk about the concept a little more. Michael Taylor wrote this story. It's a wonderful story. Rene Echevarria did a rewrite, which is uncredited, but it's still Michael Taylor's story, and he based it on the real-life event of an interview that J.D. Salinger gave, who, of course, wrote The Catcher in the Rye. And he stopped writing in 1980, and in 1980, he gave an interview to a high school student that just showed up on his door, the way it happens in this episode. I don't know if it was raining that night, though. I'm not clear on those details.
Did he offer tea, Chris?
I don't know those details. but that was the basis for the idea. And I think it's a really great way to set up a story. And it's a great way to frame the story. And it also shows how making Jake a writer, even though that seems odd as you're going through the show, perhaps, I mean, it set this up. They can do this because they've already established that Jake is going to be a writer. And for me, it's a great concept for a story, and it's great that Star Trek can step out of the t- types of stories and storytelling that we're accustomed to on Star Trek and tell this other story, and it can work so well. So, Will, what do you think about the framework of the story and the concept?
I think it works. I think when I was dating my wife, actually, a few years ago before we even got married, we actually watched this episode. I think this is one of the first Deep Space Nine episodes she ever watched. I think she just randomly was there when I was watching it, and she got sucked into it. And the thing is that, you know, you as a longtime fan, you'll get more from this episode. But the core of what makes this episode so strong, you don't need all that stuff. It's a story of, you know, he is an older Jake telling someone how he lost his father and how he's trying to get him back. That's all you need to know, basically. And trying to understand the emotional turmoil that he has to go through each and every time he sees his father and then loses him again. It's like losing him all over again. And that's very resonant to someone. You don't need to know anything about the Star Trek mythos really beyond that. And that's why, you know, she cried after that episode. I cried after the episode. I feel it's tough for me not to when I watch this episode. And I think it's...
No matter how many times you see this episode, right? I've seen this episode countless times. And then I was watching it on the train last night and like trying not to cry on the train.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's so fundamental. I think, you know, obviously it's set up in a very Star Trek sci-fi way. And I have to chuckle because the way they use subspace is how subspace is always used in Star Trek. It can be this miraculous thing. It can be anything, right? You can communicate instantaneously through it. It can be some sort of magic temporal signature thing that has a tether. It doesn't make any sense, but that's beside the point. But it allows you to set up this conceit of how do you deal with loss if it happens again and again, and you're left with the illusion that is actually reality, that you can actually bring him back. What does that do to someone, right? And I think that's so interesting. And you know, I'm not a father myself, although I'd like to be a father down the road, and I can only imagine how this episode would affect me down the road. Because personally speaking, it affects me, although I don't have the closest relationship with my father. But I think every time I watch this episode, it makes me think that, you know, life is fleeting, and maybe I should actually try to have a more in-depth or a closer relationship with my father. And it makes you think in ways that... is much more personal than, you know, the standard Star Trek episode.
I mean, to me, that was always one of the unique things. I was going to say most unique, but nothing can be most unique. The unique thing about DS9 was the Jake-Ben relationship, because, you know, in most stories, whether it's Star Trek or anything else, you always have, you know, whether it's DS9, Voyager, Enterprise, whatever, it's always the conflict. Oh, here comes the, you know, it's like Bashir's parents. Oh, we don't get along. And then that's the story. But with Ben and Jake, it's sort of this is the solid foundation where there, I mean, little conflict, but basically that no, there's this big center of love and understanding. And to me, it's almost alien. Not that I have any bad relationship, but it's sort of this very loving relationship, even when Jake gets older. Because you're like, okay, well, Jake's little in the beginning, you know, father and son, they lost their mom, they're going to be closer. But like, you know, even when he's taller than everyone in the cast, you know, they're still loving and hugging and kissing and all that stuff, which to me is very, you know, alien that, you know, that a father and son and two men, you know, can be that, you know, show their love that way. And it's normal, you know, they're always saying, you know, I love you, Dad, I love you, Jaco. And it's something I'm like, wow, that would be cool to have that kind of relationship, which is sort of alien to me, which I know that was big. I believe so. That's big for Avery, that he wanted to show, you know, that you know, an African American father and son can be close together, and it's not a story of them being absent. But then, just, you know, regardless, just a father and son, because you also don't see a mother or daughter, or whatever. And so,
well, you know, I mean, Avery and Sirach got really close, and I think you can tell that here. We're in the fourth season. I think you can feel. I think that's one reason this story works so well too, is that you know that they are close as a man and a young man at this point. And Avery is like a father figure to Sirach. So it isn't two people acting that. It's real, and I think it comes through.
Yeah, because to me, one part of this episode that's hard, and it's really the central part, is hard for me to not follow, but I guess to be empathetic, to understand the character, you know, whether it's me being a fan or an actor or whatever, is that, and I know we'll talk about this, but, you know, adult Jake or future Jake or old Jake, whatever you want to call him, you know, that his life falls apart and that he loses his identity, which to me, and maybe just because I'm not in that position or I don't have that relationship that they have, to me, I'm not like get over because I don't mean that. But to me, it is like, is it a little much that, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 years? And so, I mean, to me, that is the heart of this episode. But to me, that is the struggle to find that, you know, because where you have Ben's telling Jake, hey, you need to move on, and Jake doesn't. And so to me, that is sort of, I have to try to get that.
Well, he kind of moves on for a while, and then he becomes obsessed with getting his father back. Yeah.
Yeah, the grief of losing his father alone changed Sarah Loughton into Tony Todd. So you can see the grief on his face. I think maybe just that aspect of the father and son relationship might be the most alien aspect that Deep Space Nine brought to the Star Trek universe.
Yeah, I would agree.
That's definitely an interesting concept. But this concept of having two characters actors that we haven't spent a lot of time with carrying an episode might be also something that Deep Space Nine does better than any other series. So this isn't the only time that they do this. We get multiple Klingon episodes just on Martok's ship with just Martok and Worf for an episode. We get multiple Ferengi episodes. There's a season 7 episode featuring Nog and Vic Fontaine for an episode, and they're done very well. It takes a lot of guts to take risks like that, especially considering Michael Dorn was fresh on the set. He's like, all right, where do I go? Like, just stand there this episode, Dorn. No lines for you. Like, this is a very different show.
But we need you here because we need your connection to actually get the Defiant back into the Bajoran system later.
Yes.
While we're talking about the concept, I definitely want to talk about performances of Tony Todd and Rachel Robinson. So while we're talking about Jake so much, let's talk about Tony Todd. How do you guys feel about his performance as the adult Jake and how it makes the episode work?
I think on one level, when you first see it, you're kind of like, whoa, Tony Todd is a totally different person, literally, than Sarek Loughton. His voice, his personality seems different. And when I first saw this episode, I think, you know, you kind of had to transition a little bit, like, oh, that's old Jake Sisko. Okay, I'll go with it. And they had originally tried to introduce Sarek Loughton as an older character with makeup. It just didn't end up working. And I think because Tony's performance was so strong and because of the arc that they're trying to, they'll tell you, that event, him losing Ben, him losing his father, made him into a different person. You know, the older Jake Sisko played by Tony he's not the Jake Sisko of before. He's older, he's wizened, he's had to grow up even faster. It's almost like he had the death of his mother early on, and he had the death of his father. So by the time you see middle-aged Jake Sisko, it's perhaps not the Jake that you thought he would end up being, but that's the point. The point is that this event changed him so much that he becomes just a different person. He becomes someone that's a little bit older, a little bit wiser, a little more world-weary, and not quite the same. Because even when you see him and he's with his wife and Nog and they're celebrating his book, you notice that there's still something a little bit off. And that I'm not saying that it's a different character off. It's how he's acting. There's still something gnawing at him. And I think having a different character play him, a different actor play Jake altogether, ended up working really well because Tony Todd was so great in this episode.
I mean, I think one thing that strikes me about Todd's portrayal is that old Jake, I wish we could come up with another name than that. But anyway, he really seems, and I'm trying to think of another word. So this, I don't mean this in a pejorative way, but he seems immature. Has not aged in some ways, that he is that Jake, you know, because he's the way he, you know, he falls apart and the way he, you know, and I don't mean anything bad about that, but like when he's crying in the Defiant with Dax and even when he's around, you know, Commander, Nog and his wife, you know, it almost seems like Todd is playing young. Like he is that Jake character.
Well, I mean, do you think that is in part that Jake, although biologically he aged, he's also stuck in time at the moment that
I think so
that happened?
Yeah. I mean, you could. I mean, I don't want to get that deep into it, but it could be that he has just locked himself in that time, other than, you know, studying sciencey science for 30 years, that he has stopped himself to be that person because he, you know, even though he is married and done tried to write, that he wants to be that person for his dad because that's what the person his dad knows, which I know that's probably overthinking it, but.
Hey, overthinking it is what we do on the Ready Room, Philip.
I keep hearing bajorative, like bajorative.
Bajorative, yes.
This episode is very bajorative. Something I thought of, Tony Todd is amazing in this. I can't imagine a 16-year-old Ciroc Lofton in 90-year-old makeup. My guess is it wouldn't have worked as good. Something I just thought about, too, is that the hardest thing about this is, you know, what he went through losing his father and knowing that he was out there. And then at least at the end, you're left with a glimpse of, all right, this is taken care of. It didn't happen. But then when you look at the overarching plot of the show, this does happen. He is going to lose his father, and his father's going to disappear, and his father might reappear from time to time again. So we might still see part of this future, and that's kind of depressing. But Tony Todd,
so this was
great actor.
This was foreshadowing, you're saying, in the middle of DS9?
They got some aspects wrong. I'm sure Jadzia Dax is going to leave a nice, healthy, long life, but...
Well, I saw in the middle of this episode that they did visit the Celestial Temple. I don't know why subspace looks like the Celestial Temple or the Q Continuum or the Future Guy place. It's just a set they use in Star Trek.
I was thinking that maybe Ben is hanging out with the Sphere Builders Enterprise.
Wow. Hashtag, it's all connected. It's all connected.
That's right. I mean, subspace, you think bottle shows help you save money on the budget? Subspace sets are really easy to build.
Oh, maybe he's on that planet with Apollo.
Oh, yeah, maybe. So, I mean, with Tony Todd, for me, the beginning of the episode, I feel like the performance is a little bit odd and a little bit stiff when Melanie first arrives and just the way he's talking to her. It's not until he starts telling her the story where I think that he really settles in and the emotion really comes through. From that point on, I feel like he does a really nice job of portraying someone who really has lost themselves in the despair of being unable to get their father back. I mean, if you look, like in my situation, I know I can never get my father back, so I have to just move on with my life. If I were in a situation where I knew I could get my father back. And I think this is what people probably feel when they have a loved one who has been taken prisoner, for example. You know, someone's a hostage. Like, you can maybe get them back, but you can't personally get them back. So what do you do? And I also, maybe I'm jumping ahead to father-son relationship here, but part of the concept of this is at the end when Jake says that I've been dragging my father through time like an anchor, I think that in this story, that's literally happening, right? They're tethered. But even if you were to lose your father or you lose a loved one, but you emotionally can't get past that, it's still the same thing, right? They're still an anchor on your life and you're dragging them through time.
Yeah. And I guess the struggle I have with this episode, and again, I'm not empathetic because it hasn't happened to me, so I'm trying to be sympathetic at least. But, you know, it seems like the lesson of this episode, and again, I'm not trying to make fun of it, is don't get over it. Like, you know, everyone tells Jake, move on and you know, live a life. And even his dad tells him, and he's like, no. And so to me, the question I'm left with at the end of this episode is, you know, it all turns out fine, right? Yay, old Jake killed himself and everything's back in our prime timeline. And that's all we're happy about. But I'm like, is the question of Jake's sacrifice versus Jake moving on, and like, which one is necessarily the right decision? Like, if Jake had just moved on, would that have been the better timeline or the better experience versus the son sacrificing himself for the father? So,
yeah, Jadzia would still
really
be alive.
That's a really interesting point, Philip. Right, so that's another point I actually want to address. It's like the altered timeline, right? Things that didn't happen that happened in the rest of the series. But you bring up an interesting point, Philip, in terms of how do you deal with loss and the emotional trauma, right? I think this is something that Star Trek has always had an issue with, right? You have an advancement in medical science, but it's often almost always on the physical realm, that they're really good at solving physical wounds. They can like patch a bone. They could just do something. They'll scan it. It'll be healed. No problem. But the mental health aspect of it almost seems like it hasn't advanced at all in the future, right? This would have been a prime example for a social worker or a therapist to work with Jake to deal
some
with this loss.
And
you kind of have that with Kira.
Assistant counselor.
But you don't, exactly. You don't have that dedicated, you don't see it at least in the episode,
yeah.
A dedicated counseling session or a dedicated person to help him work through this substantial emotional trauma. You have Kira, who isn't a counselor by training, the first officer trying to lend a hand, but you know they're not equipped to deal with this. And you have Nog trying to help him too, but he's only his friend. And it's just kind of put aside. Like, he'll be fine, he'll get over it. And I think that's the limitations of both an episode that has to wrap up in 45 minutes, but I think it's also the limitations of Star Trek, right? You know, you have a crew that's a quasi-military. It can't be fully thought out, even in Deep Space Nine, which is relatively thought out. You don't have what you would think would be there in terms of resources for Jake coping with this loss.
Well, at this point, too, Starfleet only had one counselor, and she just crashed the Enterprise, so.
That's true.
And she's the only counselor in the quadrant.
And they'll have a counselor down the road in season 7, but only after Jadzia dies and there's a new host. Which doesn't happen because she doesn't die in this timeline, right? So
I'm picturing this is like TOS, Philip. The Enterprise is the only ship in the quadrant. And Troy is the only counselor in the quadrant.
Exactly. Yeah, and it was interesting because I'm doing my DS9 rewatch and I'm about at the end of season 5. And even though this is only, you know, a season and a half or whatever the math would be before, like, to me, it's so totally different. Like, I'm watching this episode like, remember when the Klingons were a thing? Yeah, that was a while ago. You know, I'm in the heart of Dominion stuff now. And it's all like the Klingons are in the threat and they took over the station. I'm like, and the Dominion just stood there. They were cool. We're good. We're just going to be over here at the Gamma Quadrant. We're good. So, but I mean, I'm just making fun because they maybe didn't know where they were going yet. But it's just interesting to listen to all that and, you know, all the characters and all the things that would come later. But
yeah. Yeah, I was thinking the same thing when they brought up the Klingons. They do mention the Dominion. But so much of this, because coming right off of Way of the Warrior, obviously, you're thinking the Klingons are going to be playing the bigger role and threatening the system. The idea of Bajor entering a mutual defense pact with the Cardassians was really fascinating. I think it shows the importance of Benjamin to the Bajoran people, because without him, I mean, the whole linchpin is gone. Everything, the entire future unfolds differently for the Bajorans without him.
And I wonder if word, you know, how did word ever get leaked out that Ben was reappearing to Bajor? Because, like, man, I'll tell you what, the Vedix, there were probably 8 million reinterpretations of what that meant, you know, so.
Yeah, I'm sure Wynn wasn't very happy about it.
Yeah. And there was this is going to be left field, but I'll just throw this out as one note. It almost gave me, and if I'm getting this name wrong, please tell me, but the Marie Celeste story, is that the ghost ship that would appear? You know, every years. I sort of had that spirit of that to me, of that.
Yeah. I think all the points that you guys are making about, you know, the counseling and all, in real life, I have to do air quotes, but, well, Star Trek's real life for us, right? So in this future, in real life, that's what Jake would need. But of course, if they had that in the story, I think the story would be a fairly uninteresting story. The fact that Jake feels alone on the station, if you go back to Emissary, you know, there are great moments here too, because, you know, the series ends with Kira and Jake looking out the window. And here we've got Kira and Jake in front of the window. And Kira's telling Jake, you need to go. It's not safe here. And he says, I can't go. You know, this is my home. And when you contrast that with when they arrived at the station and how much Jake didn't want to be there, and the fact that now he's grown up on this station and he really feels like that's home, and he feels like that's where his father is as well, and he can't leave, because if he leaves, then he won't have any connection to his father anymore. It's a great connection. It's a great thread that runs through the series, and it's brought up here kind of in an unexpected moment. But I think for the story to work, you do need Jake to feel isolated and feel alone on the station. And really, it's not a Federation. I mean, it's not a starship, right? So the fact that they don't have a counselor there isn't necessarily surprising to me.
That's true.
Well, I think Chief O'Brien did have a counselor when he went through his imprisonment thing in his head.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And
it worked
time,
out great for him.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting. That's a good point, Chris, because Joseph Sisko died, right? So they were talking, and he's talking to Melanie. He said, you know, my grandfather passed away. And I think that was probably another linchpin that was gone too, is that for a while he was able to find a semblance of a normal life. He got married, you know, he had all this stuff. His grandfather probably helped him in a lot of ways too, because obviously Ben was close to his father, right? So obviously Joseph Sisko would have really felt that loss too, and having him gone, and then he thought his life was normal, and then having his father reappear, I think that most definitely played a role in him feeling that he really had to put everything he had to in trying to get him back, as there was nothing mm-hmm. left, right, at this point. He didn't have his grandfather, didn't have all this stuff, and he owed it to himself and his followers to make that attempt. And it's really interesting to see kind of the similarities with how this plays out in the end of Deep Space Nine, how, you know, I think you've mentioned it, Jeremy, he's going to lose his father in another capacity, and we don't know what's going to happen and how he deals with this. And we don't know if when Ben comes back, if he ever tells Jake that this is what happened in an alternate timeline, that this is what you tried to do. And there's a lot of emotional weight that Ben is probably carrying, because he knows all this stuff going forward.
I get the impression that he wasn't going to tell Jake.
Right.
Yeah, because he doesn't want, I mean, you're kind of like, I'm like that, you know, with my own son that, and my daughter as well. There's certain things that you feel that it's better that they don't know in situations like this, just because as an adult, you know how that knowledge burdens you and how it shapes the way you see the world and how you progress through your life. And as a parent, you feel the need to protect them from that. And if it's something they really need to know, well, that's one thing. But if it's something that they don't really need to know, then maybe you want to give them the freedom to pursue their life without being burdened by that knowledge.
And to me, it seemed open-ended. Maybe y'all can tell me, I just totally missed it. The ending to me seemed open-ended about whether Ben remembered or not. Because I left thinking like he kind of...
No, I think he knew.
Well, yeah. He just said like, I don't know. What, because, and he seemed very distant, like he just had like an instinct of what to do, but I don't know. It seemed open-ended, but maybe
I feel like the way he hugged Jake and put his head against his head and you know, kind of grabbed and hugged each other and said, I'm okay now.
Yeah.
I think that's him saying, yeah, we're going to be okay, because I think he remembers everything. For me, that's what made the episode that much more emotional, is that he does retain that knowledge going forward.
Right, yeah. That's how I read it as well. What about you, Will? Did you take it that way or more like Philip?
No, I agree. I think he definitely remembered. And I think that's the interesting thing, and sometimes the frustrating thing about Star Trek, is that a lot of these episodes end with a lot of... There's a lot of impact from it, but because the and Deep Space Nine carries over some show threads, but oftentimes there are things that they can't carry over. And this isn't really referenced again, but when you think about it, it's much like Picard's Inner Light. It's much like all these deep character episodes, that it can have a substantial impact on a character, that down the road there is narrative material to mine there. There is something that could be explored in terms of how does Ben carry this knowledge of what happened, and how does that affect his relationship with Jake in the present and going forward. I'm not saying that, you know, it was a bad idea not to revisit this. I think it ended perfectly. But I think that's the really great thing and frustrating thing, too, at the same time, is that this episode brings up a lot of questions. But because of the nature of Star Trek, it's like, all right, so next week we're going to continue. And for the most part, we're going to go on with a different tangent, different story. And we might take on some other elements, but this is the emotional impact of it wasn't carried over. Although, if they wanted to, I think there is material there for them to really explore.
Because I guess what I was left with is, if Ben does carry the memories of this, to me, and again, I'm not a father, so I'm more interested in what, you know, Jeremy and Chris here think. The worry I would think Ben would have, he'd be, you know, feel the love of his son who sacrificed himself for him. But he would also, or I'll just say me, I won't say him. I would be worried that Jake, you know, needs to maybe have, again, I'm trying to say this mean, needs to have some independence. You know, in other words, that Ben has to be worried that Jake is going to grow up being dependent on his father always needing to be there, which I'm sure Ben would love to always be around his son, as you know, any parent would. But, like, you know, I'm not always going to be around, son. You know, I want you to be happy. I want you to have your own life. I want you to meet someone you love and you know, have your own children maybe and make your own life and be self-actualized. Because I think, you know, Jake – as a character, and I'm not, again, not a bad thing, but I think Jake always has a problem as a character being his own self. It's either he's Nog's sidekick, he's Ben's son, he's, you know, what, O'Brien's helper, you know, and so there's never like Jake just is Jake.
Well, I think that's the message that Ben is trying to convey to Jake when he reappears over time. Like, I need to know you're going to be okay. I need you to move on with your life. You know, I need you to live your life and not be so worried about me. I think the problem is that, well, two things. So as far as Jake having trouble being himself on the station, let me tie it in this way. Because in this story, Jake loses his father very early. The years where Ben would be trying to teach that to Jake and help him become his own self, Ben's not there. And so Jake doesn't have that. And so as an adult, he was never taught that by his father. And he's so obsessed with getting his father back that he's never progressed past that. Now, outside of this episode, I think what happens on the station is that Ben is a very hands-on father. He very much loves his son, but he's in a very, very demanding position. And so the amount of time he has to actually be a hands-on father for his son is limited. And so I don't think that he gets that guidance from Ben that he needs, that he would in, say, our own situation where, you know, we're all together in a house and we go to work, we come home, you go to school. It's a different situation. And so he doesn't get as much of that guidance from his father, even though Ben wants to give it. And that's why I guess I can read the way the character is on the show as being realistic in that he doesn't have that. Although he does have a lot of other positive role models around him, you know, like Miles, like Jadzia, like Morn. Kira, other people, Morn especially. Yeah. So
I think what they show too is that when Jake actually let Sisko, when he let his father go, he actually, when he just moved on, he did a great job at making a life for himself. He had a nice house. He was a writer. Every time he didn't think about his father, he did a really good job. He did great. He even went on and done science. I think he could do anything he wants if he puts his mind to it. It's just the aspect of his father reappearing that completely destroyed his life.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think to Philip's point, there's a through line in terms of, I think, Jake becoming his own man. And I'm picking up on what happened at the end of Call to Arms when Jake, as a reporter, decides that he wants to stay on the station. And then Ben finds out and he throws down the pad. And I think it's a great scene of acting. Great acting where he's just so frustrated with the fact that, you know, Jake is on the station and it's occupied by Dominion. Obviously, very dangerous. And then Bashir says, do we go back for them? He's like, no, I'm not going to go. I can't go back and risk the life of everyone on the ship for one man, even if it's my son. He's a grown man who can make his own decisions. And you kind of see the growth there. I wish there was more growth for Jake in terms of his character, but there were elements there.
He's 8 feet tall, Will. How much growth do you need?
That's true. I meant emotional and character growth, not physical growth.
Okay.
But yeah, that's. I think you do see Jake really becoming his own man, and you see him, you know, becoming self-actualized. And it's. I think they sort of explore that, the relationship he has with his father, and his father being both the emissary and both being this great military tactician. And there's also another scene that's really great in Valiant where Waters kind of throws it in Jake's face in terms of, you know, he's a little disappointed. He's a little condescending that it was that Jake didn't join Starfleet, but his because right. his father is so great, it's a little disappointing that his son didn't follow his lead. And I think it's those little moments where you kind of see Jake becoming his own man. He doesn't want to join Starfleet. He wants to become his own man. And I wish there was more of that, but it is there if you're looking for it. And I think that's the great thing is with this series, you can pick up these individual data points and then you could actually make a logical argument that there is growth along this on this trajectory of character.
And I think that's a stumbling block for maybe a lot of fans with Jake is that what do you mean you don't want to join Starfleet? Like that's what we all want to do. And so like in some ways that can, you know, we're almost as annoyed as, you know, that character with Jake, like how come you don't want to, but I think it's an interesting choice. And I think it does work that, you know, no, that's not Jake's thing at all. He has zero interest in being Starfleet and in being like a captain. Like we all want to be on a bridge or whatever. And
even Nog wants to join Starfleet.
Yes. Yeah. You know, Captain Nog.
And that's so, a great segue into the fact that Nog is captain so fast, right? And Bashir and Dax are commanders and they're clearly advanced in age. And Nog is just, he is just on this rocket ship of career advancement in this alternate
timeline. We call it the Sulu plan, where you become captain, but all your friends are stuck on the commander ceiling. He's on the Sulu career track.
Well, I think that Bashir would not become a captain makes sense because you don't see many doctors who
Beverly
reach
Crusher.
The rank of captain. Well, she, okay, well, yeah, of a medical ship, right, yeah, in the alternate timeline, yeah. But Jadzia not being a captain is... I mean, I guess maybe her coffee obsession in the future kept her from becoming a captain. They were worried that maybe she would be a little bit too jacked up on the caffeine in a crisis situation or something. I don't know. Or maybe she just couldn't. She couldn't work the panels because she always had a cup of coffee in her hand.
Maybe she didn't feel like getting promoted because she knew she was going to die in an alternate universe anyway.
Ooh, maybe. That's deep.
Yeah. Or maybe she said, "I've been a captain before, so."
There you go.
Been there, done that. Yeah.
Maybe she was waiting to get her own space station because I hear commander can be a pretty good rank.
That's true.
So that's another thing. They reference Worf and, you know, he pulled strings on the Klingon High Council. So is the Worf in this universe the same Governor Worf in All Good Things? Is that the illusion that it's the same Worf, right?
Well, okay. So we're going to kind of. We'll have to jump around for that. I was going to bring up the future time.
Oh, sorry about that.
I'm going to save the future time frame for the end. I do want to talk about it. Just quick answer to that. I think the answer is yes, but then we'll talk about the future time frame after. While we're talking about, let's rearrange our order of our outline a little bit here as well, because we're talking so much about Ben and Jake, father and son, and Jake on the show. I think that... what this highlights, and you see it elsewhere in the show, is that even though Serac Lofton does not appear in a lot of episodes, and Jake is definitely an underutilized and underdeveloped character throughout the show, if you remove Jake from Deep Space Nine, I think you have a completely different show because the character of Benjamin Sisko would be a completely different person because if you actually watch through the series and you pay attention to the relationship between Ben and his son, it shapes so much of who he is as a man and how he interacts with the rest of his crew and how he handles situations as well, that you really need to have Jake there.
Well, I mean, Ben is the only character, I mean, feel free to correct me, where family is in the core of who he is. I mean, no other series or other character. I mean, you could say O'Brien to a certain extent, but even then he's married to Bashir more.
But as the lead, as the captain, it's definitely, absolutely.
Yeah, and so to take off that support system, you know, there's no support system because he's not married, or at least he's a widower, and, you know, until he meets Cassie and all that stuff. But I think that does drive him. Though all this talk about, you know, Jake and Ben and then what you leave behind, you know, what this reminds me of is... you know, Ben does have a child he'll never meet. Cassidy is pregnant at the end of Deep Space Nine. And so it's not abandonment. It's not abandonment because I hate to use that word, but it's whatever you want to call it. You know, what about
saving
that
the
child?
Galaxy?
Yeah.
Yeah. Call it saving the galaxy.
Yeah.
Potato, potato. I mean, come on. But that's a really interesting, that's actually, that's a good point you bring up, Chris, because that is so true that Jake is a fundamental part of Ben. So I just thought of this. What if this episode was reversed, where it's Jake who is shifting through time? It's Jake who is going, that is slipping through, and it's Ben who's seeing Jake. Does Ben go through the same process of, does he push aside his Starfleet duties? Does he go to New Orleans, work with his father, and then go back and do subspace mechanics and become a PhD and try to do that? Does it follow the same parallel, but just for the father?
Yeah,
and it's really interesting.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I agree. And it probably would have included a lot of conversations they would have with the prophets, his role as the emissary, right? Maybe in this role, he would say, you know what? I don't care if I'm the emissary. I don't care if I'm a captain in Starfleet. At my heart, I'm a father. And it could be navigating all three of those responsibilities and whether or not they can be in balance or they're in exclusion to each other.
Because to me, what the visitor does, and again, it's my struggle with this episode, not in a I don't like it way, but in a sort of emotional and psychological and intelligent way, because it turns it on its head. Because, and again, I'm not a parent, and y'all are, but like, you know, that the child does not sacrifice themselves for the parent. You know, what you're saying, well, of course the parent sacrifices themselves for the child. That's, you know, theoretically every parent, you know, dies before their children, and that's, you know, natural or whatever. But this episode turns it around, and I think that's, you know, why Ben is so frustrated as he keeps reappearing to Jake, that, you know, no, it's not your job to sacrifice for me. I sacrifice for you. And so that's where this episode turns it on its head.
But the twist is that their roles become reversed because Jake is now older than Ben. Mm-hmm. You know, Ben says at one point, like, you're older than me now.
Yeah, you learn a lot in those 50 years.
Psychologically, the roles get reversed, though, because what you're saying is true. Like, as the child, you're not in the position usually that you're going to be sacrificing to save the parent. I mean, we say that. Of course, there are situations where, yes, maybe you do that. But just what we're talking about here, it would seem odd. But I think it's not odd in this case because, from Jake's perspective, so much time has passed that he's not really looking at it in the normal way where, you know, he's 16 and his father's older. And okay, well, we're spending a lot of time on, we're kind of mixing up topics in our outline, but one thing I don't want to miss talking about is Rachel Robinson, because she is someone who's actually a singer, really, not an actress. And she's the daughter of Andrew Robinson, who of course plays Garrick. And they said they auditioned a lot of actresses for this role, and she just blew them away. And I can see why, because she really blows me away here as well. There's just sort of an innocence and sort of a natural feeling to her in this episode where you do feel like maybe she's a student and she's come and she's met this writer who she admires. And she's so enthralled by being in his presence and being in the house and seeing the desk where he wrote the novel that she loves. And she's so fascinated by the story that he's telling that it's one of those moments where, you know, someone really does transcend what's written on the page. And it really feels like it's just coming directly from them. And for her to be someone who we don't see elsewhere. And yes, she has been on other shows and guest roles before, but she's not primarily an actress. I think they cast this role so well. And the fact that sometimes you can think, oh, well, she's the daughter of Andrew Robinson, so Andrew got her into the show. But you don't feel like that at all. You feel like she's the perfect person for this part.
Is that just like an inner light where, like, gee, I wonder how Patrick Stewart's son got that role?
No, so I'm not saying that.
I'm kidding.
Well, Philip, I mean, you know, how do you feel? You know, you're a writer. You're also an actor, a stage actor, so...
Yeah, it's an interesting which I know, you know, this is me overthinking it, because, like, they wrote it in the 21st or 20th century, but to me, you know, we'll pretend here, it's the 24th century and late 24th century at that, because this is old Jake, that he's still using, you know, tactile writing technique, because even young Jake actually uses a pad, so I guess he just went retro in his old age. And the two books... not crazy about the hologram covers, but we'll see what the future holds. You know, whatever.
I thought this time, watching it this time, I thought, like, it's a little bit Harry Potter feeling there with, like, maybe the images on the cover move, or, you know.
Yeah, and I felt like the third cover had, like, the Jake Sisko. It almost looked like the More You Know star in the Sisko writing. Like, it was very 80s kind of glam. But but it was interesting. I think they did set it up, though. Apparently, in the 24th century, you can just waltz into people's houses, and it's cool. That's good. It's very, very secure.
Apparently,
in the future.
No locks on the doors, right?
Yeah, and just, you just get
paradise, guys. Come on.
I know. That's right. But...
Although I thought Jake had moved to Ferenginar at one point. I mean, Nog comes in. There are all these great worms and grubs and bugs outside, Nog says, and it's raining like crazy.
It's raining a lot, yeah.
Well, Chris, you don't know the bayou down here. We got grubs growing everywhere. But one thing I liked, like you said, Chris, she did kind of give this sort of... you know, very impressive and very creative. And I always love how she was like, oh, I'm not a writer. Like, you know how to be a writer? Just say you're a writer and you write that. You know, it's really not rocket science. But I do like that she plays that role. I mean, it's legitimate what she's doing because she's very like, sort of like, I'm not confident, but you're great and I just want to be like you. But one thing I almost wish is that she would describe his writing just a little more, because like, I'm actually interested in like, what were these stories like? What was it that motivated her? And I mean, she's very good at saying, you know, brought me alive. I'm just like, give me a little bit more about like, is it a romance? Is it a mystery? Is it, you know, is it Hemingway? Is it narrative and evocation? But I thought it was cool.
Well, what do you think it is, Philip? That's part of the fun of the episode. You get to decide what Jake wrote in the future that made him so famous.
I assume it was a series of pop-up books, but that's just, no, I'm kidding.
Yeah, I think all of you brought up really good points about how she was the perfect surrogate. She was the perfect stand-in for the audience, right? You need this as a framing device because there's obviously so much going on with the scenario as the episode starts. So you need someone that is very relatable, that would ask the same types of questions, but also set up the setting in a believable way, that she is meeting almost a professor or someone that she really admires. She's a student. I could see her being like a college freshman, or she is just new to her craft and she's just so intrigued. And through her, you can understand like what is going on. What is this episode all about? And because when it first starts, you're just totally thrown for a loop in terms of what's going on here. And mm-hmm. she just does a terrific, I wouldn't say understated, but just it seems so natural. It just seems like she really was this person. It wasn't a role that she was playing. She really was curious because she is meeting this man that is such an enigma, that she respects this person so much, but yet he has this giant life-altering enigma that he's telling her, and through her, you know, it's telling us, the audience, who's also equally in the dark.
Yeah, definitely. That's how I feel about it. And I think that's why her performance works so well for me. All right. Well, let's move on, because there are a couple other things that we want to touch on here. And the time is passing really quickly. This episode, I think we could probably have a 3-hour discussion about The Visitor and still not touch on everything.
Wait, doesn't this episode subject appear every 100 episodes in the Master Feed?
Maybe that's what we should start doing. Yes, we'll just have it reappear every time the Master Feed undergoes its inversion.
Right, which happens.
Which happens.
Make a wish.
Then you'll be able to hear us talk about The Visitor. Let's return to what you brought up earlier, Will, when you asked, is the Worf of this timeline, who pulled strings with the High Council, the same Worf of All Good Things? And earlier I said, yes, I think it is. And the reason I say that is because they use the same uniform design and all. So in reality, probably it's not exactly the same, because every time an event happens and the timeline splits, there are going to be some differences. But I do find it interesting that they always go back to this uniform design. And you feel like the changes have to be relatively small. You know, they're not the kind of timeline changes that we get in the Abramsverse, where things really, really diverge, thanks to Mr. Nero. But here we see the same elements that we see in All Good Things. And more so than talking about Worf here, what I want to ask you guys about is that Rene Echevarria commented in the Captain's Log supplemental book that he was disappointed that many of the scenes that they filmed of the future time frame with the crew interacting with one another had to be cut for time. I think that's where you maybe divide into two different camps here, where with Star Trek, are you more interested in all the different characters and the technology and the ships and the timeline? Or are you more interested in how the characters relate to each other and telling a tight and emotional story like what we get here? I think that there's just enough of the overall crew and the future time frame here to facilitate the story without it interfering with the story that's being told. And if you had all of those other elements in there, if you had those other scenes, you would have to sacrifice Jake's story in order to have the other characters in the future. So how do you guys feel, Jeremy, for you? How do you feel? Should there have been more of that in, or does it work the way that it does now?
No, I think it works the way it does now, because the story is about Benjamin and Jake. Plus, we really do get to see the future of a lot of these people spread out throughout the series episodes anyway. We know Worf becomes a grizzled ambassador that probably still hates Riker, whether Troy died or not. We've seen what Odo can become a few hundred years down the line just from watching the episode Children of Time and see what he can.
Yeah, great story.
Right. O'Brien and Quark, I don't think they're going to be changing much anyway. They're pretty much set in their ways. We see Bashir Nog and Jadzia, which is nice knowing Jadzia is going to have a wonderful long life ahead of her. Really, the only one I would have liked to see what happens with would have been Kira. Because I think her future out of all the major cast members throughout the series is the most open-ended and mysterious. But everything else, I think we can kind of piece together. And it's about the father and son. So I think it's fine. Mm-hmm.
And I think if I had one of my co-hosts, Daniel Prue, here, he'd be very excited because it's just a bridge full of blue shirts. And that's all he wants. So that's all, you know, the blue shirts get to come to the rescue in this one.
But I think Daniel would be interested in knowing how nacelle technology differs in this timeline in the future.
Well, he would also say it probably only takes one person to run the entire Define, but that's.
It would be like Tasha Yar gushing about how deflector shield technology has advanced so much since Castillo's time, basically. I think I'm of two minds, because I definitely understand the necessity of, you know, this being a very, you know, episode is focused on Ben and Jake. It has to be economical. It has to be focused on them. It has to be very tight. At the same time, I think there's a lot of potential, and probably a lot of it was left on the cutting room floor, unfortunately, that there is a lot of interesting potential between Jadzia and Bashir, how their relationship evolved with O'Brien, who couldn't be there, but would have been nice to kind of see. I think it would have worked if it was a larger episode, right? So let's say Visitor was a two-hour finale, like All Good Things, it becomes larger in scope, so you can fill it out with more time. But within the confines of this episode, just being the second episode of the fourth season, you know, it really had to be tight. But at the same time, there is interesting questions, especially with Nog. The fact that he becomes, I'd like to think that the Nog in the actual prime timeline becomes the Nog that we see here, that becomes a self-confident, self-possessed captain, that he becomes so much more than what he was when he was first introduced. I'd like to think that that's what happened. I'd like to see that growth of him, and along with all the other characters too. So, you know, I think I'm of two minds with this. I definitely respect the reason why they did it, but at the same time, there's a lot of narrative material there to mine.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad they didn't show it, because really the little that we showed, if you really want to think about it, doesn't make sense, really. The Defiant is still around 50 years later.
Well,
and they
do mention that nothing was working when they came aboard the ship.
Yeah, and
so they did have to get
two-dimensional,
you know, pull the ship
displays,
out of
Chris.
Great line. Yeah.
Well, Philip, as you mentioned in our Facebook chat thread, the great thing about being Captain Nog is that you get to choose your own ship.
That's right. Yeah, they tried mothballing her a few years ago, but yeah, they were going to put that actual nacelle on it, but
I think the nacelle sticking off the top of the ship, it was a little bit gaudy.
Yeah, it was going to be like a vertical one, just to be different.
Yeah,
but like a mohawk. But
they may have stolen the Defiant from space dock. Who knows? It could have been and they had like
the
an Excelsior 2.0 comes.
Right. But because it's such a small ship, they didn't need to go through the space doors. They just flew it out of a ventilation shaft like the Millennium Falcon.
I mean, who would even notice it's missing, really? You know, it's
right.
But I think, but if we're still, but if we're talking about the future timeline, I also think it does deserve mentioning that the Dominion War does not happen. That does, I mean, I think that's very, right. And I think obviously there are in-universe considerations. They still had yet to map out where they wanted to go with the war, but it's very, at least for me, it was very striking that the war never happened. Is it because Ben didn't mind the wormhole? He didn't mind the entrance and never provoked them to kind of, Cardassia never joined the Dominion. It's all these what ifs, right? And I think that's the interesting part of it is that the Klingons, it seems, in this timeline are they're the big bad. In all good things, they were still fighting the Klingons and they were a big bad. And here, they're the big bad. I think it's really interesting that so much of what we know Deep Space Nine to be never happened. And it's because Ben's not there. And that just shows you how important he is to everything.
Yeah.
Which I have to wonder, what was the space station called under the Klingons? And you know how sometimes in your neighborhoods, maybe it's just mine, you have that like one restaurant that just has like the worst luck. It changes hands every like 6 months. You know, it's like a sushi restaurant, then it's an Italian restaurant that just can't keep it in business. I think that's what Tarak Nor is turning into. You know, it's first the Cardassians, then the Federation Bajorans, now it's the Klingons. It's like they just can't keep that business going.
You know, I think they reverted back to the Cardassian name, but they Klingonized it. It was Terach Nor.
And there's like an apostrophe between the T and like the E.
How about Terach Kor?
Oh, yeah. There you good. Go. All right. Because you want to honor your great leaders when you name things. So,
And so the Klingon restaurant is basically Morn's right now. And so that it's really big. It's expanded. Yeah. There's a buffet. It's really nice now.
Except the Klingons made him put a U in the name. They're howling all the time in there. Yeah. All right. Well, yeah, I'm glad. I guess I said this at the beginning. I'm glad they didn't put too much of that future stuff in there because I think it's cool. And I love it in All Good Things where we see the future uniforms and the future technology and all. But I just think it would have disrupted this story too much.
I'm picturing, Frank or how Quark was always complaining. He always had these like bottles of Kanar, you know. Now Morn just has all these bottles of root beer. Because the Klingons don't drink it. But he just has bottles.
They're not bottles. They're A&W cans.
Oh, okay, yeah. But he just can't get rid of them. No one, Klingons don't drink root beer.
I can see Nog's dorm room at Starfleet Academy. It's just stocked with six packs of root beer.
There's no other soda in the future, apparently. There's no Mountain Dew. It's all root beer. That's it. They don't drink anything else. That gets me every time.
You didn't see them coming, did you? You never see the one that dominates.
That's right. All right. Well, let's touch on one last thing here. And this is just the question of, is this Star Trek's best? And by best, I don't mean the very best episode, but I mean amongst the very best episodes, because for me, this is right up there with The City on the Edge of Forever, the Inner Light, you know, the best of both worlds, just the very best stories that Star Trek has ever told. And a lot of fans, I shouldn't say a lot of fans, but I talk to fans who don't like this episode. And they say, oh, The Visitor, yeah, I don't really get into that episode. It's really overrated. It's boring. I don't like that episode. And I think that shows how different fans get different things out of Star Trek, which is one of the strengths of Star Trek, that you can pull what you like. You know, if you like the science fiction, if you like the spaceships, if you like battles, if you like the technobabble, you can pull that out. If you like the character relationships, you can pull that out. For me, this episode always connected with me more once I had my own children. And now, as I mentioned earlier, connects with me on a whole different level now that I lost my dad, and lost my dad in the sudden and shocking way that Jake loses his dad. So how do you guys feel? Do you feel that, I mean, I don't think any of you guys feel it's overrated after the discussion that we've had so far, but when you hear other fans say that, what are your thoughts on it?
I think this cannot be labeled the number one Star Trek episode of all time, only because it lost to another Star Trek episode for an Emmy the same year, Voyager's Threshold. So yeah. It's not quite
but
as good
makeup,
as Threshold.
Though,
that's true. That's
lost
true.
For makeup.
It is important that we let them know that.
The problem, Jeremy, is that when your tongue falls out, when you pull your tongue out and show it to somebody, you can't beat that, right? So
you can't. They got it right.
What was Jake gonna do?
They got it right.
If he had pulled his tongue out and shown it to Melanie, then maybe they would have won.
Man. Yep.
All right.
Hindsight's 20/20. But, I think that.
But when fans say it's overrated, I mean, can you see that point of view?
I can see it, Chris. And you've actually mentioned another show or another episode that I think the same thing with, and that's City on the Edge of Forever. I kind of see there's the same similarity that they say it's not Star Trek-y enough. It's good sci-fi, but it's not Star Trek-y enough. And I love these two episodes. Both the episodes strike a very similar chord with me in that they're wonderfully written, acted. I think each captain gives one of the greatest performances of that of their series in these two episodes. And the criticism that, maybe it's not Star Trek, but you know what it is? It's just pure, good, well-done science fiction that's firing on every cylinder and perfectly nailing that emotional note. So I don't know if it's Star Trek, but I love it. And it is Star Trek.
How do you feel, Will?
I think people feel it's overrated because I think there's sometimes people have that reaction because they hear so much about a particular episode. Maybe not necessarily the actual merits of it. I think that's how most people would react to hearing, oh, this, they always hear about this episode. They kind of hear it has a reputation. So when they see it, it could be that the expectations for them are so high that no matter how well the episode actually is on its merits, it just can't meet their expectations, or it doesn't meet where the expectations were. They were saying this is the best Deep Space Nine episode, or this is top five. They're thinking in their mind an expectation of what they think a top five Star Trek episode would be. In their mind, they're thinking what a top five DS9 episode would be. Mm-hmm. And this is very much, it's a great episode of Star Trek, but it's not like Star Trek in a lot of ways, but that's what makes it so great, right? Because it's so versatile. But for other people, I think sometimes there's a natural backlash to say the contrarian thing, but also there's also a reaction towards their own perception, their own expectations of what they would think a best Star Trek episode would be. For me, I don't think it's overrated at all. I think it's properly rated. I think it's actually Star Trek in a lot of ways. The very premise itself is very much what Star Trek does really well: establish this sci-fi framework to then tell a very personal character-based story or a moral allegory. That's the best Star Trek, in the same vein that similitude was with Enterprise, the same way Inner Light, TNG, City of the Edge Forever, Star Trek, a lot of the Doctor episodes in Voyager, those are the best types of Star Trek episodes. But I could see why people would kind of, you know, if they're hearing about this all the time and then they see it, they're like, so that's it, huh? This is the one that's supposed to be the best one. It even involve one of the main characters. They're just, who's this guy, right? Who's this woman that's there? So,
yeah. Well, you got one of the main characters, but he looks different
to
you.
Right.
So, yeah. What are your thoughts, Philip?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's overrated, but I'm not as much of a fan of City of Edge Forever and Inner Light and it's just, I don't know, it's just me personally. I don't want to speak for any of the fans other than Philip. You know, that to me, I prefer the big issues being tackled, the morality plays, the aspirational hopes for what we can be and what we can do, because the Inner Light and the Visitor like this and City of Edge Forever, to me, those are much more, and I'm struggling for the right words, but like people issues and person to person and the immediacy and real life, I suppose, in a way, which to me is very dramatic in a good way. I mean, they say drama, but to me, that's not necessarily my Trek fandom of what draws me there. So I could, if I did my, you know, 50 top Trek episodes, you know, The Visitor would not be there, not because it's not a good episode, but just, you know, it doesn't pull my, I guess, intellectual strings or spiritual strings or whatever strings I have in my Trek fandom. But that's, I can see why folks like it. But again, as a big of a TNG person, Inner Light, everyone says it's not my favorite. So I'm just you know, my own iconoclastic opinion, but I don't think it's overrated. That's just personally why I would not see it. So, I mean, I don't know, this whole, like, it's not Star Trek is whatever someone says it is. That's what Star Trek is. And I know it's Star Trek because when the credits rolled, it said Star Trek. So I don't have any problems of making that connection, but, you know, to each their own.
All right, guys. Well, I want to keep talking about this, but we've been going way over an hour, so we should wrap up with our final thoughts and our ratings on the episode. So, Philip, what are your final thoughts and your rating?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, this is, I'm going to just ramble and repeat everything, but I'll do it in a very short manner. it's a good episode because of family and Jake and Ben and making what has been such a subtle, subtle thing throughout the four seasons or three and two episode seasons of Deep Space Nine we'd seen at that point, and just making it its own episode, but in an interesting way. You know, it's not necessarily a time travel episode, I mean, per se, but it's not. But it's you know, how can I make this father-son relationship be this key part? And it's a unique way that draws you in and is so different and unique. And I just said that twice. But I think that's what makes The Visitor probably so compelling for so many people, that we make a relationship just the whole episode, and it's compelling. And as for my rating, I would probably give it 3 Mothball Defiance out of 5.
Wow. All right. How about you, Jeremy?
Yeah, I like this episode. Definitely in my top 50. The whole father and son thing, I don't think any other Trek has even come close to touching that. I do the Star Trek Wars podcast as a thinly veiled attempt to share all the Star Trek episodes I loved with my 12-year-old son, Connor. That's the main reason we do the podcast. This episode is just the most honest, real, and moving representation of the love a father and son share. I could honestly watch this every day for the rest of my life, and I'll still get choked up every single time. You know why? Because it's real. They created it, and it's real. So I give this a 50 out of 50.
You've been saving that all show, haven't you, Jeremy?
I've been saving that since 1998. I'll give it 50 out of 50 wormhole inversions.
All right.
You took mine. That was a good one.
I love the concept, and I'm going to ask you more about your podcast at the end here, but I love that you created a podcast to share Star Trek with your son. That's awesome.
He'd rather I had done it about Doctor Who, but he gets what he gets.
No. I thought he wanted you to do a podcast about One Direction.
Yeah, that's definitely after Trek.
Right. All right, Will, what are your final thoughts and your rating?
Yeah, so I can only echo what Philip and Jeremy said. It is such a good episode for me because you get so much from it each time you watch it. Obviously, I'm not a father yet. I would imagine when I'm a father down the road, I'm going to get so much more from this episode. But even watching it now hits you in a way that is just so emotional for me. And like Jeremy said, this is really the most meaningful father-son relationship you see in all of Star Trek. You really don't see the captains have a lot of personal relationships in any of the series, and yet this one just hits it so well. That's at the core of what Ben and Jake are. And on top of that, I really enjoy this for the fact that this love is the love between, it's a familial type of love. It's a filial love. It's not necessarily romantic love. And they mentioned that in the Memory Alpha article, and I agree. It's a lot of times love is through the prism of romantic love, but this is through a father and son familial love, and it's so strong. And it's such a unique take that you don't really see in Star Trek. And it's so powerful. And I think a lot of people kind of not necessarily overlook this episode, but I think because it has a reputation of being the top episode, when they go into it, if they have the wrong expectation of what a top or best Star Trek episode is going to be, then they might say, oh, well, that's it, huh? That was the one of the best, right? And I think that's the wrong attitude to go into this. I think if you just watch it for what it is, you really kind of get what it's trying to say. So for me, I'm gonna have to give it 5 out of 5 holographic Jake Sisko book covers.
Great. Yeah, when I look at Star Trek stories and I personally decide which are the best stories, more often than not, I think I base my decision on the storytelling itself. And I especially like stories that can be separated from the Star Trek elements and still work. And so at the beginning, when I said this is a great science fiction story, and Philip, you mentioned that it's just a great drama, which it is, I think there's a misconception often that science fiction has to mean space and sciencey elements, and it's really not. You know, you can have a science fiction story. I mean, Lost is science fiction. I think it's interesting that Lost was so successful because I think that that was a case where they made a science fiction show that the public didn't realize was a science fiction show. People who aren't into science fiction could get into it without feeling like they were watching science fiction. And this is a story where you could take all the Star Trek elements out of the story and still tell the story with almost the same impact. And when a story works on that level and also works as a Star Trek story, I think that the writers and the creatives and the actors have really accomplished something incredible. So for me, this story is definitely in my top five Deep Space Nine stories. And if I were to do a top maybe 20 Star Trek stories from the entire franchise, I would have this in there. Sorry, Philip, I have to go closer in than the 50 there, but you know,
top 70 there. I said it's not even
there. You go. Okay, so I just, you know, I really love this story, and it was so difficult to watch this story last night. And Jeremy, you mentioned you could watch this every day for the rest of your life and still get choked up. And for me, I think that's where it would be very difficult, because I think the emotional impact of this story is something that at this point in my life, I could only watch this as much as I love it. I could only watch it occasionally because it's too intense. So those are my feelings. I have more feelings on this, and I don't think I can focus them at the moment or even get them out. So maybe we'll do this on the orb. I was thinking this morning, actually, that I might, for my next column on StarTrek.com, I might actually do this, because the last one I wrote was about time, and it's not published at the moment. I think it might be soon here. And it kind of ties into this, the way that Jake is fighting time as he's dragging his father with him as he ages. So I don't know, I might touch on this. Anyway, I'm going to give this episode 4,747 variations of the final paragraph, because that was the number at the top of Jake's pad, 4747. 147 reference was not good enough for this episode. They had to double up.
For both current Jake Sisko and future Jake Sisko. That's why. That's yes, the inversion.
That's why. That's the inversion. All right. So thanks so much for joining us today, guys. Before we go, tell everyone where they can find you on the interwebs. And also, Jeremy, tell everyone a little bit about Star Trek Wars and where they can find that, where they can find you.
Well, Star Trek Wars podcast is a podcast we've been doing for a couple of years now. We take an episode from all five Trek series, and we review an episode in chronological order, and we review them, compare them against each other, and debate them. And what we've incorporated now lately is over on our group page, our Facebook page, fans can go in there and vote on the episodes themselves. And that weighs into the episode's final score, and we'll read the comments. Like I mentioned, I have my 12-year-old son, Connor, and we have a new host, Jordan, who's doing a great job. And you can find us at Star Trek Wars on Facebook and help and join the conversation there. We're just a few episodes away from wrapping up season two, so I'm really excited to jump into season three of all five Treks. You can hit us up at Twitter at The Star Trek Wars, and we're on Stitcher, iTunes, or wherever your fine podcasts are free to find.
Awesome. Yeah, it's a really fun show. I really like the concept of it, so I hope people will check it out. All right, thanks, Jeremy. And Philip, where can people find you?
They can find me each and every week here on the Trek.fm network on Earl Grey, the Next Generation dedicated show. And I have to say, it probably is in the top 105 podcast episodes, if I had to make a list, and along with Darren Moser and Daniel Prue. We talk about all things TNG, and often what TNG episodes those remind me of. But they can also find me on Twitter, and my handle there is NC Public Servant. That's NC for not counting.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks again for joining us, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So that was a wonderful discussion on The Visitor with Philip and Jeremy, Chris. I think we could have gone on for 3 more hours. I think there's so much in that episode to talk about.
We really could. You know, we always do an outline for the show, and we only had 4 major points on the outline for this one. And I told you guys that if I break it down into everything I want to talk about, we're going to have like 8 points, and there's no way we'll get through those. And we were like about 50 minutes, and we were technically still on the second point, although we had covered the third a lot. And yeah, we had to wrap that up prematurely. The time went by so quickly. I hope it did for everyone listening, but I was just so caught up in the discussion that could have kept going on and on. But I hope you enjoyed it, and thank you for listening. As I mentioned at the top of the show, we have many more shows for you here on the network, so check those out, itunes.com/trekfm. If you are an iOS user, if you're an Android user, go to our website, grab the RSS, go to Stitcher, SoundCloud, BlackBerry, Windows Phone. If you use those devices, we're all over the place. Go check out all the other great shows on the network. Now, if you'd like to leave feedback on today's show, there are many ways for you to get in touch with us. You can go to Twitter. Our username is TrekFM. On Facebook, our regular page is facebook.com/TrekFM. We have a contact form, trek.fm/contact. Go to that page, use the form you find there, choose to send to a show and choose the ready room, and that will come to me by email. You can also go to speakpipe.com/TrekFM and send us a voicemail, or come join in the bigger discussion in the Babel Conference on Facebook. That's where everyone goes to extend the discussions that we have on the show. We'll tell everyone a little bit about the Babel Conference.
Sure. So it's our dedicated Facebook group just for our listeners. We only advertise it on the shows, and we just want to have our listeners be part of this group. And we have a robust community there where we're just having really in-depth, intelligent, but respectful conversation. That's also fun. About all things Trek, but also all things geeky too, because 602, we're talking about, you know, comic books, we're talking about other franchises, sci-fi, what have you. It's just a really great community. And from there, I think I've made a lot of good friends from that group. I've made just so many, met so many great people, and also just really learned a lot from that group. So if you're listening to this, please join us in the Babel Conference. You just type in B-A-B-E-L conference in the Facebook search bar, and you should be able to find it, and we'll let you on in, and you can join the discussion.
Yeah, it's a fantastic group. So come join us over there, and you're going to find a lot of great people to talk about. And if you're a Star Wars fan and a Star Trek fan, this is a place where you can talk about Star Wars, and you're not going to get bashed, because we talk about it all there. All right. Well, Will, we talked about Warp 5 at the top of the show, and we talked about the Patrons Roundtable as well. So tell everybody where else they can find you around the network or around the interwebs, and what you do here at Trek FM as well.
Sure. So you can also tweet me at @will_win. It's spelled N-G-U-Y-E-N. You can always tweet me about all things Trek or anything geeky. I'll always respond. I'm also the content manager for Trek FM. So if you have any ideas on what you want us to talk about in the future or things we've talked about in the past, feel free to drop us a line. We'd love to hear from you. And of course, I'm an associate producer for the network, for The Orb, for Earl Grey, for Literary Treks. And like I mentioned before, I'm also a co-host for Warp 5 and The Roundtable. So if you have any ideas on what you want to hear from us, please drop me a line.
Sounds like you're becoming the Jeffrey Combs of Trek FM, Will.
I only wish I had the acting ability to both be a baseball and also potentially be Melanie and also be Wei Yun and Shran, I think.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, we didn't mention that in our notes today. It said that Jeffrey Combs was the baseball in this episode. In fact, I didn't even mention that I'm so glad that the baseball played a central role in this story, because it's such an iconic element of DS9 representing Benjamin Sisko, and the fact that Jake took that with him was awesome.
Yeah, Jeffrey really had an understated performance that day as the baseball. Really subtle.
He did. But it was a very well-rounded performance.
Oh, all right. Man, that's good.
So if you would like to find me, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, the letter C and Brian with a Y. That's also my name on Facebook. You can find me in the Babel Conference on Facebook. I have my website at cbrianjones.com. Elsewhere on the network, you can find me doing The Orb with Matthew Rushing, where we talk all things Deep Space Nine. So if you enjoyed today's discussion, you definitely need to check out The Orb. We have wonderful Deep Space Nine discussions there on that show. And I also occasionally do Hyperchannel. I produce the official Axonar podcast, which is hosted by Alec Peters and Robert Miner Burnett. And then if you want to read my writing about Star Trek, you can find my stuff on the official website at StarTrek.com. My column there is called Trekspectives. And actually, Will, I think you didn't mention, but you do writing as well. You write for TrekNews.net.
I do. So I'm also a contributing writer for TrekNews.net. And I've done a few articles where it's just, it's ranged from episode reviews to talking about my love for the Akutagram, because that's why I love Star Trek, is the design, the ships and stuff like that. So I'm not as regular as I used to be, but I like to be as regular on there as much as possible. So check it out if you just want just an overall dose of Trek geekiness.
Yeah, it's fun to write. I mean, it's great to talk. I used to write a lot more before I started podcasting. It's great to talk, but sometimes I do like to sit down and just write as well. So you can find that stuff on those two sites. And then outside of the world of Star Trek, if for some reason you like listening to my voice and you like to hear me ramble on about things, you can check out my non-Trek podcast, which is called Metropolis On Air. That is tied to the magazine that I run here in Tokyo. I do a lot of interviews on that show, and we talk about all kinds of topics, sometimes from the world of entertainment and elsewhere, but also you can find out about Japan, life in Tokyo. We have Japanese language lessons, really short ones in there, and we do all kinds of fun stuff on that show. You can find that in iTunes if you just search Metropolis On Air, or go to metropolisjapan.com and you'll find it there. If you don't see it on the front page, just type podcast in the search and it'll come right up. One more thing here. I really want to thank our associate producers on The Ready Room, Renee Roberts and Zachary Fruling. Renee is a wonderful woman who has been supporting the network almost since the beginning. We would not be here without Renee, and I really mean that. And you can find her on Twitter. Her username there is mares_1701. So please say hello to Renee and thank her for her support of the network. And also Zachary Fruling, who you heard on the last two Ready Rooms. He is an associate producer here, and he's becoming very active on the network, on mic, and doing a fantastic job. So we really thank Zachary for his support as well. And a reminder that you can join the team as well and support us through Patreon at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. Please go there. Check out the ways that you can help us out. Every little bit makes a big difference for us. And it's only thanks to our patrons on Patreon that you have these shows, because it costs a lot of money to run this network, and we really could not do it without everyone's support. So we thank everyone out there who is supporting us, and we hope that everyone who is not supporting us yet will consider doing so. It makes a big difference, and it helps the whole family, because we really are a family here at Trek FM, and we'd love to have you as part of that family. All right, Will. Well, that is our show for this time. I'm going to head out in the rain because I want to catch up with Melanie, sit down together, and read through those new stories that Jake wrote.
Yes, I really had a great time talking, visitor, but it's time to stick a mothball defiant in it, because the Ready Room is done. Do you want me to wait for Jeremy to come back?
Yeah, let's wait for Jeremy to come back.
No, I'm Don't moving on, guys. Second. I'm going to live my life, okay?
You're all about moving on. You're like, get over it, Jake.
That's right.
Get over it. Come on.
Write another book. Geordi's going to overtake you.
Oh, man.
Yeah, there's a scene where Jake, he picks up the paper. He flips to the books section, and he sees Geordi's name at the top, and he's like, damn it, I'm gonna write that next novel starting today. And I'm not gonna rest.
You know what happened is he wanted to get his revenge. If he couldn't beat Geordi at writing, he was gonna beat Geordi at engineering. So that's why he studied for over 20 years. I'm gonna be a better engineer.
That I love the fact that that's just something you can just do in the future. Like, you know what, I am just going to stop mid-career, but it's a career PhD. That I don't have to depend on my livelihood. writing, right? I can just do that. Yeah. I'm just going to take up like quantum mechanics just for the hell of it and just and get a PhD in it. And just, I love that, that's in the future. Like that is something that could happen. And I just, it's so cool. Like, okay, let's just do
writing this. Was his fallback. That was his safety. I'm gonna go adventure this engineering writing. Science stuff.
Okay, Jeremy's back.